Oak Session number 10602, Reel 33.
Mr. Elliot, Reel 33. I'd like to ask you why you did want to re-engage at this time, having completed 12 years' service.
Well, I only had 9 more years to go to receive a full pension for the rest of my life. And as a sergeant then, the pension would have been a good pension. Considering at that age then, I would have found it difficult to have found another job back in civilian life after having been wounded in service. I was rejected by 2 commandants at hospitals, and I was rejected by the commandant at the retraining centre, where I was only there a fortnight because they said they couldn't do anything more for me. From there, I was posted to an older unit at Hartlepool in County Durham. When I arrived there, the staff there were nearly all Durhams, either regular or TA, the staff. I forget the name of the CO at that particular place, but I soldiered with them in the 2nd Battalion. And I had an interview and asked. He said, well, you haven't been here 6 months. He said, now can I give you a character? So I was rejected there.
You were asking for the same thing?
Same thing. After being there a short while, I was posted to Sighthill, a little bit north of Edinburgh, to go with a disarmament unit, as there was supposed to be an invasion of Norway to take place. Well, while I was there, VE Day came, so...
Can I ask you a little bit about this disarmament unit? What did that do?
Well, it's a follow-up unit to follow-up units, the small units, when an army has won, there's a lot of equipment to be taken and catalogued, and that was the job we were supposed to do because we was not fit for field service, but we were fit to do sedentary work, if you like. That's the follow-up work.
You still retained your rank of sergeant?
Oh yes, I was war established then. Once you were appointed sergeant and you did it for 6 months, you became war established. They couldn't take that away from you unless it was court martial.
So as a sergeant in the disarmament unit, you had men under you?
Oh yes, some more men. Men who'd been wounded or who'd been very ill and were unfit for further frontline service, if you like. And all these men had been badly wounded or like myself, were unfit for service. But they were capable of doing a follow-up job.
Did you think that this was a worthwhile thing to do?
Oh, yes.
Doing it?
Yes. At the time, I thought, yes, it was a job. And I was doing something to help the war effort. Oh, yes.
You didn't feel demoralised by it?
Oh, no. I never felt demoralised any time. The only time I felt demoralised... When my rejection for re-engagement, and that I still feel a little sad about, if not bitter, sad at least, that it didn't happen.
Okay, so you stayed with this disarmament unit at Sighthill in Edinburgh. How long were you there for?
Till VA Day, and then when VA Day came, we were ordered back to the Hartlepool again. But again, while I was at Sighthill, I approached the CO there for to re-engage, and he said, well, you haven't been with me 6 months, so I was turned down again.
What sort of things did you do at Sighthill? Can you describe as a routine there?
Oh, there was just a hutted camp, I think, and they were just gathering the men together. You know, they were just... We hadn't done any training, really. We were just, if you like, mobilising. We were just getting the various men together and the various groups together when VA Day came, and we did nothing, really.
So you didn't actually learn how to do the job?
No, there was nothing, because the time I arrived and the time I left was didn't matter, because VE Day came and the war ended. So they could have, the service troops, if they'd wanted any, they could have just sent them in any time, and the job would have been done.
Can you tell me about VE Day? Can you remember anything about it?
Well, I was just in, I think I was in Sight Hill. That was it. It came, and then the CEO just turned around and said the operation was off. We'll be returned to where we'd come from. And I was sent back to Hartlepool. And when I got back to Hartlepool, I was told I could have, I think it was 14 days leave.
Were you sent back to Hartlepool actually on VE Day?
I think so, either that day or the next day. But the operation was finished, so the unit was, as the Germans say, kaput, finished.
What did you feel about that? Were you sad about that as well? Or?
No, it was just accepted.
Did you celebrate VE Day? You call it
no,
celebrations?
No, I didn't drink. I don't drink. I used to like a glass of cider, sweet cider, not the rough stuff, but... No, it was just another day to me. The war was ended. I was pleased it was ended, because I knew a lot of lives would be saved, preferably lads of my regiment, because they'd had a rough do. And for everybody, you know, that you get a feeling, a relief. You turn around and say, "Thank God for that," or "Thank the Lord for that," or something. But I think I might have said a little prayer, never mind about celebrating, but I was happy it had finished.
What about the continued war with Japan? Did you have any feelings about that at the time?
Oh yes, I thought those lads were doing a rough job, worse than what we would be doing. They were forgotten, you know, they were the forgotten army, and they'd had a rough do, because the Japanese were merciless. They were even worse than the SS. But
did you realise that at the time?
Oh, we knew. We knew the reports that was coming through at the time of the bayonet and of nurses and patients in hospitals. We'd been read that in the media. We knew that had happened.
Did you believe it as well?
Yes. Oh, yes. Because you may not remember or recall, but before that, when the Japanese had first gone into China, there was newsreel pictures showing Japanese beheading Chinese in streets or anywhere, marketplaces or open grounds. They were beheading them, and there was pictures shown of it. So, you knew then, and when they went into Pearl Harbor, without declaring war, you could expect nothing from them. At least... that is, as a professional soldier, his view. I don't know what the rest of the public thought, but I had a feeling that would happen. And you know, when you say that, although I wasn't there, our 2nd Battalion was with the only British troops who were the first to defeat the Japanese in a land battle. And that was at Kohima, or leading around that area. And the Durham suffered the heaviest casualties of the lot.
Did you realise that at the time as well?
I didn't know that had happened until afterwards. But it did.
Okay, you said you were sent to Hartlepool on or just shortly after VE Day. What were you to do at Hartlepool?
Well, I was sent on leave, fortnight's leave, and then when I returned...
Were you able to meet your wife there?
Oh, yes, the family. I was with the family for a fortnight here, up in Sunderland Street in Horton. I went back, and as soon as we went back, we were told we were on an urgent posting to Germany. Well, we left Hartlepool, we arrived at Tilbury.
How did you feel about going to Germany?
Just another move. It was just another job. You get used to it. And we got to Tilbury, we got over to Ostend, and nobody knew about us, and we were sent to Blankenberg. There was a place on the Belgium coast, and we were there for a while, We were at a draft to take to a place, and then suddenly we were told we had to go to Holland. We arrived at Helmond in Holland, and when we reported that to the military, they knew nothing about us. We were in Helmond a few days with the Dutch. Then we were told...
May I ask, George, what were you doing at Blankenberg and Helmond? Did you have any duties there at all?
No, we were just supervising these reinforcements to this supposed urgent job. But nobody knew what the urgent job was, nobody knew what the reinforcement was for. And
so you had nothing really to supervise?
Just the lads that was with the draft. There was two sergeants, at least two sergeants. There was a lad from the regiment, and there was the men from the regiment, the draft who were taken out. And we got to, as I say, we got to Belgium. Nobody knew anything. And suddenly we were pushed into Holland. Nobody in Holland knew. We were pushed from Holland to a place called Reine in Germany. When we got there, they didn't know anything about us. And after a while, they sent us up to Hamburg, where we went into Hamburg, and they didn't know anything about a draft being wanted.
What was this draft meant to do?
We're coming up to it. So... on another day, we were told, the draft was told, to get the gear together. They would be taken to the unit where they were supposed to go. And we arrived at Scharbeutz on the Baltic coast. It was a leaf centre. They were making it into a leaf centre for the forces in Germany, or in that area of Germany. And this was in Schleswig-Holstein, on Lübeck Bay. And... the place was organised for to bring the troops for a rest away from, and as you know, there was no fraternisation, supposedly. Well, when I arrived there, I ended up, guess what?
You tell me.
Provost Sergeant.
Your favourite job.
My favourite job. And when I met the RSM, he was a Scots lad, RSM Gibson. I know him, he was about 6 foot tall, smart lad. And he said, "Sergeant, I'm giving you a job." He said, "It's a good job, but if you put anybody on a charge," he says, "you lose your good job." Because all the lads that had come and been in the field, you know, a lot of them had had a rough time, and they were coming to relax. So he said, "You turn the other way. You know what I mean?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, that'll be the end of it." But he says, "If you don't," he says, "you lose your good job." So it was the most unlikely provost job I'd ever done in my life. Let's put it that way. And
how did you feel about becoming a provost sergeant again?
Well, when I'd been given those instructions from the RSM, I didn't accept it as a provost job. I accepted that I'd just been given a job to kill time. And
could you describe what the camp was like?
Oh, just houses and hotels, where the Germans had had hotels and houses, private houses, which hadn't been damaged by war. And
the men were billeted in there?
In the houses and in the hotels, and they were getting good meals. They were being well looked after. There was entertainment for them, and there was the beach, and they could go for about nearly half a mile out without drowning. I mean, they would have to fall down in the water and lie there to drown, because it only came up to the knees, yards out. Beautiful sands, and the weather was good. There was always ENSA concerts for them, or there was some kind of entertainment for the short time they were there, maybe 3 days or a week or so. But whatever time they were allowed there, they had to relax, and we let them relax. Didn't matter what the rank was, we never bothered them about the dress or anything.
Was this a camp where both officers and other ranks?
No, just other ranks. Wasn't officers, it was all other ranks. And I used to patrol an area of like a square. It maybe wouldn't be square, but it was like a square. And that was my job, and I had about half a dozen police. And they used to just walk around in twos, just to say that there was, as you know, at that time, there was a lot of people who had false documents, trying to get out of it. Because in the next village down below us, there was a military prison, if you like, for the SS and Gestapo who had done wrong, either male or female, who were waiting to be tried. And that Irma...
Yes.
What was it? No. The one from Belsen, the female from Belsen, the vicious person from... She was in the camp next to where we were at, the
Did
village.
Did you realise that at the time?
I was told by the military police, because the military police used to go into our area, and I spoke to them and I said, Irma Grace, I think that was her name, Grace or something like that, or Grace. She was a vicious person. Nasty.
So your job was to check documents and make sure that they were...
If we saw any strangers. You know, we got to know the people of the area, but if anyone was passing through, you would stop them and go through the... and what they were carrying.
Did you ever come across someone who you suspected of having forged
documents? One. I placed them under close arrest.
What made you suspicious about that person?
Instinct. Edgy. He was edgy. He was wanting to be away. He didn't seem to be the person he seemed to be. He was handed over to the military police. That was the end. I got to know no more. You see, it wasn't our job. We just detained them and the military police took them away. Then there was another occasion while I was there. The commandant, a major of the Royal Artillery, I forget his name, he came for me. He said, sent word. He wanted the provost sergeant. And I went. He says, have you got a weapon? I said, a rifle, but I cannot use it. He says, well, come to my quarters and I'll give you a revolver. And we were in the jeep and he was driving. And he said, if I give the order to fire, he says, fire to kill. No hesitation, fire to kill. I said, can I have reasons for that, sir? None. He said, if I give the order, he says, just shoot and shoot to kill. Now, we searched the area for a while. We never saw anybody. He never saw who it was. And he returned to his quarters. He said, I'll have the revolver now. And that was the last I heard of it. And I never knew what it was about. Shortly after that, I was posted from there to Kolding in Denmark to a similar camp. There was another holiday rest camp at Kolding, which was a German military barracks.
Can I ask you before you perhaps tell you a little bit about Kolding camp? Did you come across German civilians whilst you were at the camp?
Oh, yes.
How did they react to you?
They didn't seem to believe that the atrocities that had happened.
Did you actually talk to them about that?
Oh, yes. Some of them could speak English. Well, there was a point of view which I'd just missed there. There was two prison ships in Lübeck Bay, and it seemed the Allied Air Forces had sunk them. And there was a lot of prisoners and staff on those ships when the ships had sunk. Now, one period of time, there was a very strong wind blowing from the sea, and it caused a lot of bodies to be washed up on the beach. And I went to the burgomaster and told him it was his job to have these people buried. And I got a remarkable answer from him. He said, your aeroplanes sunk them, so it's up to you to do. I said, don't you talk to me like that, lad. I said, this is your country. I said, and we are the victors in this war. I said, your people put them in those prison ships. I says, and your people will bury them. And it was for about 3 or 4 days. Oh, there'd be around about 100 bodies. And they were all in the, like, blue and white circled trousers and a blouse kind of thing. Or a shirt, you know. Some still had watches on the wrists and what have you. But they got farmers to bring their carts out and take the bodies away. I don't know where they buried them, but they had to clear the beaches.
What about the ordinary other German civilians you met? Did you?
Well, they were breaking.
Was there any hostility between them and the British troops?
I never felt any hostility. I made. We were not allowed. This was the nasty point. The war was over, but there was a government order: no fraternisation. And if you wanted to learn as anything at all, you couldn't. But me being a provost sergeant, I could always make the excuse that I thought they were strangers or not doing right. And I could talk to them that way, you know. And I knew the troops, I knew some of the troops that was on rest were going with some of these women. But I, as I say, I'd had instructions to look the other way. And I know on a number of occasions sergeants and private soldiers came to me and they said, is thou the Geordie Provost Sergeant? I said, yes. So I said, well, it's all right then. We're now all about thou. So this was something that did happen. It seemed to travel through here. But I made friends with a family, two families. I couldn't openly do it, but they used to sit on the beach with the children, and I used to talk to the children or give the children a piece of chocolate if I had some, you know. And the two females could speak a little English, and when I explained to them what had happened, you know, they couldn't believe it. They didn't even believe. Even when the war was finished, they still couldn't believe the concentration camps had been there, even although it was in the papers, and I showed them it. And they still couldn't believe it. It was remarkable how the propaganda machine in Germany, what it had done to those people.
Were the German population very short of food and so on by this time?
Well, there didn't seem to be when I was there. They may have been short of many things, like we were through war. Yes, the luxuries, maybe that. But they never seemed to be short of food.
Okay. Can we move on to Kolding now in Denmark? You said you had a camp there.
Well, just before we go to Kolding, I had an interview with the CEO, the commandant at Scharbeutz. Could I re-engage? Well, you haven't been under me 6 months, so I can't give you a recommendation. I was posted to the other camp, which was half of the camp I was in.
But smaller, I mean?
It was a similar sort of camp, you know.
But it was much smaller.
Smaller, more compact. And I was made senior. I was the only senior general duties person up there. So I was doing the duties of a WO1. And again, after being there a good while, I had an interview with the commandant again, and he said, well, I'm sorry, but you haven't soldiered under me for 6 months. Then we had a welfare colonel come out, and I explained my situation to this welfare colonel of the difficulty I was having in trying to re-engage to complete 21-year service, and I wasn't being allowed to remain in one unit for 6 months so I could get a character recommendation. He says, oh, I'll take it up with 21st Army Group. He says, and so you got that. That was the last I heard of that. So before my 6 months was up in Denmark, I was returned to Scharbeutz.
Could you briefly tell me what duties you had at Kolding?
Well, as senior NCO there, as general duties senior NCO, it was my job to run the unit. Discipline, welfare, complaints, anything within the unit. It was also my duty to receive all the incoming drafts who were coming for leave and rest.
When you said receive them, what do you mean by that?
Well, I met them as they came in and gave them the instructions, what the rules were for the camp, the meal times, and, you know, the normal administration information which they would require.
What do you mean by that? What?
Well, any medical, if they wanted medical attention, if they wanted to go out, you know, the times they were allowed out and times that to be back in, the meal times, canteen times, if there was any entertainment, I would give them the times of the entertainment, everything else. Yes. And I also ran the sergeant's mess. I was head of the sergeant's mess. Sergeant and warrant officer's mess. Only it is warrant officer's and sergeant's mess, but in common army language, it's always called the sergeant's mess.
Was there a sort of curfew on the camp? Was there times when...
No, there was no curfew. They could come and go as they wanted. They were on leave. It was like being at home, only they were in a military camp. They had meal times. I mean, you couldn't make meal times any time. You had to have specific meal times. If they'd went there, then they missed the meal. But there was a canteen which did have certain kinds of stuff in.
Okay, thanks. You mentioned then that you went back to Scharbeutz.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened there?
Well, I was there, and I forget what job I did there. I might have taken on for Wogan, but I wasn't there very long before I was returned to England.
Did all these movements took place in what, 1945?
1945.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and from Sharpeways you said you returned back to England. How did that come about?
End of the numbers coming up.
This is your demobilisation.
Demobilisation numbers. And mine came up, and I was one of the earliest ones. And
when did that occur?
I'm not quite sure. Sometime in 45, I'm not sure.
Late 45?
No, about the middle, I should think. Somewhere in around about the middle of the early autumn.
Okay, and you returned back to England. Can you tell me the demobilisation procedure? What happened when you got back to England?
Oh, we arrived at... I'm not sure where we arrived at, but we travelled to Strensel, where we were demobbed at Strensel. And I was given a civilian suit. I kept my army overcoat. They gave me a warrant to bring me home. That was the end.
Did you receive any pensions or payments?
Yes, there was a certain fund, war credits or something we got. And then I applied for a war disability pension because of the wound I had to my hand. And I received a 20% war disability pension. There was a government order out at that time that where you had been working before mobilisation, the firm should take you back to work. Well, the firm had moved from Rochester to Northern Ireland, and when I applied to them for my job back, they asked me if I could give them my clock number, which I couldn't, and they just said there was no vacancies.
How do you feel about that?
Well, what do you feel? Disappointed. I thought I'd had a bit of a raw deal. There's nothing I could do about it, so you got on with life, got to get on living. I was pleased to be back home, but...
Did you think the army had treated you well in getting a war disabilities pension?
No. I thought I'd been... They'd got away with it cheap, I thought. I thought I'd been... You see, at one time or another, I had spoken to soldiers who had re-engaged, had been wounded, and they had been re-engaged to complete a pensionable service. And I found it strange that, in my case, it hadn't happened. Now, the rules may have been 6 months for officers, to commanding officers, to assess a man's character. But I think a man's character should be independently assessed throughout the whole of his service. And I had been serving in the army, more or less, except for about 6 weeks, for well over 12 years. And in that time, I had one regimental entry, 8-day CB. I did 22-day CB in around about 12 and a half to 13 years, nearly 13 years service. And if that didn't speak for itself, then I'm hanged if I can know how they could come to any conclusion.
Can you tell me about when you got your first civilian job?
Yes, I came out and I saw there was a notice for vacancies for bus conductors at the local bus depot. I applied for it and got a job, was there working for a while. Then there was another job came up, and I was employed with Northern Gas, and I worked for Northern Gas until I was retired.
Thank you very much, Mr. Elliott, for your help and contribution.
I had major surgery twice, abdominal surgery, and the last surgery I had was colostomy, and the medical officer for the Northern Gas said no one was ever employed in the industry with what I had, so I would have an early retirement. I had about 2 or 3 years to go.